thing is that the because of the destruction and the corruption of the system, if the 24,000 students actually passed on the transmission, so God had to remove them. In fact, Rabbi Akiva had five students later that were very outstanding, and they were the ones that passed on the Masorah, the transmission. So the thing is that you see here the reason why God intervened to destroy the why we have this why the 24,000 died because of this sin. Okay, and I'd just like to add one more thing. There is a question today about whether things that happened, that we have a state and things that happened in the nation, whether they are miracles, where certain things are miracles or not miracles. The answer is you can only tell later on in history to see if it protected the nation as a whole, then you could say that God intervened. But if you cannot say that, then at this point, I just don't see that that would be God. The only way you could see it is in the two ways that we showed, either the Rambam's way or what we're saying. Now, by the way, the idea that I heard this from about Rabbi Akiva was from Rabbi Benjamin Owen. Okay, he happened to said the idea. But anyway, so about Israel, I'm just not sure. I think it's too early to tell whether God is intervening there or not, but you have to wait for history to point out, to show us and guide us whether this is the type of situation that God would intervene in. Again, this type of relationship that God has with us is the lowest level of hashkacha, God's personal relationship. There are higher levels, and as we reach, as if we develop and reach higher levels, then God again will relate to us on the higher levels of hashkacha, or God's personal relationship. I'd just like to make an observation, okay? I've been reading biographies, you know, and I've been reading about Hitler and Stalin. And there is one thing about, there are two qualities that you must have to be a absolute evil. Okay? You must have two qualities. Okay, one quality is that you must be a thinker. You have to be a thinker. You have to have strategy and work out strategy. And two is that there is no moral conscience. There's nothing that stops you from doing that which is necessary to take complete power for yourself. Okay? Those are the two things to be a tyrant that you have to have. To clarify the no moral conviction, I mean, your best friend today, if he has a different opinion than you, you could kill him tomorrow. You understand? There's no ultimate enemy or friend. There's just today. If you're my friend today, fine. You're my enemy. Tomorrow you're my enemy, then you die. You understand? There's no such thing as loyalty. Or, for instance, even if you are my friend, but it suits me for my power to destroy you, and you didn't do anything wrong, then I'll destroy you. It doesn't matter, because you're only there for my power. That's ultimate power. It's a very lonely place to be, and there's no one you trust, and anybody could be thrown out if you just didn't disagree with me. There's no such thing as morals or ethics. And you have to have intelligence to be able to work out strategies to be able to be successful, so that you have to be work these things out, to think it through. And the question is, why, if these people will turn around and just kill you automatically, why would anybody follow them once they see such a thing? The answer is, first of all, there's a desire in every human being for power, but they don't have the ability to carry it out. Either they can't put all their energy into evil like that, or they don't have the mental capacity to be sneaky. If they have a good mind, they can't use it for sneakiness. You see, it's not, you understand, there has to be a very particular type of thinking that he has to be able to carry out. Now, since there's a desire for power, and there's also a there's in every human being that somehow I'm different than everybody else, so they think somehow they will be so invaluable to the tyrant that he'll always need me and he'll always see that I'm really his friend. But he really, the person that, what he blinds himself to is that the tyrant does not have friends. The tyrant does not have friends. You see? So therefore, that's the mistake that he makes. But the desire for power, and he knows that he'll get power by being friendly with the tyrant, blinds him to all the effects of, that he'll go out against me. And also was mentioned here that it is, most people don't want responsibility. And so therefore they just follow a leader, and that leader becomes his authority. And so therefore it's very easy just to go on, because he takes total responsibility for everything. So therefore I don't have to make these big decisions, and I just give up my conscience to the leader. He becomes like my conscience. I mean, also that many times they deify the tyrant, and therefore he is all powerful, and unconsciously he led that to most people. He becomes their religion. He can't do no wrong. He can't see wrong in him. Right. The thing is, the ultimate tzaddik must have these qualities too, okay? But the thing that he's striving for is reality. You see, he must give up. He must have intelligence and think out, and he must be able to put all his energy into the world of God and justice.
What about morality?
So therefore, he must have wisdom. And he must have knowledge to understand how to think and work things out. And he also is guided with, he's able to put all his energy into the world of searching for God. And when he finds God, the true God, then he finds that there is such a thing as justice and justice, mercy, kindness, okay? But also he does have the ability, because of God, not for personal reasons, but because of God, to be able to harm people. Like, for instance, Samuel the prophet is supposed to be the kindest of all people, he chopped a man in half. Was the enemy of Israel, he was the king of Amalek, a worst enemy, and he split him down the center with a sword, which means that he has the ability to do a destructive act. But it's all in the name of God. King David and Joshua cut off the thumbs of the five kings that he captured as a psychological warfare on the enemy to make it easier for Israel. So you see, the tzaddik must have the ability to do both. He must have the ability to do, but it's only, you see, by him, what's driving him is the relationship between him and God. And therefore, as a result, because of his knowledge of God and God's will, so he knows when to be kind and when to be tough. While the tyrant is totally driven by power, by the self, you see. And therefore, the tzaddik in the long run will be successful, and the tyrant in the long run will fail, because his own emotions will cause him to make decisions. Crazy emotions will cause him to make decisions that will cause him to fail in the long run. So therefore, they both are, see, the masses have many different emotions. They have an emotion for this, they have, you know, different, you know what I mean? Like they have family, then they have TV. They go to the bar, and they, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? There's different desires. There's friends. I mean, there's all different, satisfied, different areas. the tyrant and the tzaddik put all their energy, you see, and they are the ones that make their decision. They go beyond their emotions. In other words, a wicked person is not born wicked, and a tzaddik and a righteous person is not born righteous. Each one has their emotions which try to take them away from their path in life, and each one has to undo their emotion. The tyrant, any type of compassion, while the righteous do have compassion, but it's a result of their relationship to God, so therefore they have to remove any emotion that will take them out of reality, out of their search for truth and reality. They're driven by that emotion. That's the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha. Okay, the ultimate tzaddik and the ultimate rasha. The two extremes. Most people do not. Some people strive to put their energy in learning, but they need an outlet in other areas. So that's what they have to do, and that's who they are. So that's how they have to live their lives. That they have to have that, and they have a portion in the world to come, and they could relate to God on a high level. But the ultimate tzaddik is the person that has the ability. And that, I mean, basically, you're born with that ability, the ability to reroute all your energy to one area. And therefore, that is the personality that they have in common, and where they diverge, and they go in two different directions. Anyways, I only use the two examples of Samuel and Joshua, Shmuel and Yeshua, because you see that you have to be a tzaddik to do the will of God. Definitely they were kind. That is no question. Tzaddik has to have kindness and mercy. But however, you also see that they must have the ability to harm the enemies of God that go out against God. So therefore, they must have the ability to do anything that's God's will. They have the ability to carry it out. Nothing stops them. Okay, the Ralbag, Gershonides on the Chumash, says that Abraham had to make a decision whether to go down. It was a famine in the land. Had to make a decision whether to leave the land or whether to go down to another country. And as we see from the story, that the other country was also, it was evil. You know what I mean? They were like terrible people, and his life was in danger. So he had to make a decision. I don't know exactly what, but he had to make some type of a decision which way was safer. You understand? And the Ralbach says that you see that we cannot, the righteous cannot throw up their hands and say, look, I mean, if I stay, I die. If I go there, it's hopeless. Person can't say it's hopeless. Person must always make a decision. Even if the decision is that there's nothing I could do, and therefore I must accept that I'm going to die, I must accept that as a decision too. But it must be made that I see that there's no way out, and therefore I must accept it. But the Ralbach says that that a person must make those type of decisions and never give up hope. Okay? So I want to say that a person is responsible to make decisions under pressure. Okay? A lot of people say, I made an incorrect decision because I was under pressure. Okay? That's a good excuse for doing the wrong thing. Look, I couldn't help myself. I was under pressure. I couldn't think real well. You have to understand that I understand the problem. I mean, it is a problem. But you have to understand that the Torah holds you responsible for those type of decisions. Okay? So, the thing is that the question is, how do you get to a point where you are able to how do you go about, you know, training yourself? In other words, nobody's born that way, except in very rare cases, but nobody's born that way, basically. So how do you go about becoming such a person that you can't think clearly under pressure? In other words, if you make an incorrect decision, whether it's under pressure or not, you'll pay the consequences for the incorrect decision. We might be able to excuse you, but however, you're going to pay the consequences. There is, you know what I mean? Even though it was under pressure. So, in other words, there are different people that can't think clearly in certain situations. Certain situations just seem to confuse the mind. You know what I mean? It could be a catastrophe in the family. It could, whatever it is, it could be whatever it's based on. Everybody has a different area of person loses a lot of money. Person, family, if somebody in the family is sick, you get sick. I mean, there's different things at situations that you just can't think clearly at the time.
Okay, I understand.
Right, some people can't think clearly. They prepare for a test. They're well prepared. But the fact that they're under a test, they're under pressure, they can't think clearly. In other words, where you're able to think and where you're not able to think in the situation, that is a personal thing. In other words, some people, they have 3 months to decide whether they should take a job. They could write down the pros and cons. Some people, the whole fact that they have to change, they're under pressure. They can't think because they hate change. They can't tolerate change. So they can't think that they're going to make an incorrect decision. The thing is that you think in a certain way, in other words, like this. When you react to a situation, and you can't think about it, basically you're reacting based on your personality. Okay, however your personality reacts to a given situation that comes up suddenly. Let's say you make it second nature to think through things, that you think through ideas, you see, and so therefore the ideas, when you react based on these ideas. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, we would go through, like we would study Mishlei, but not only study it, but we would review it many times until I start thinking everything you do is there, what the consequence is. So therefore, when there comes up a sudden situation, since I naturally think that way, I will naturally make a decision that way. In other words, it must become like second nature. See, in other words, the primary nature that you start out with, that's the emotion, so whatever your personality is, that's the way you're going to react. But you can't make it second nature by review, by going over ideas until it affects you, until you can think that way. Okay? That is the first step. Okay? But you have to understand, are there any good questions? Okay, so you just review the ideas until you're able to think that way, and that's the natural response. But, however, sometimes there are very, very powerful emotions that even with second nature, these powerful emotions, given the right situation, will react. And therefore, there is a second step when you start seeing certain emotions that affect your decision-making process that has been trained, you see, then it's those emotions that have to be analyzed. Then you have to analyze the emotions itself and try to undo the emotion through the understanding of the emotion. See, if you're not trained, then basically you're guided by your personality. So therefore, you can't just work on your personality. The first thing is you must work on is the training of the mind and the thinking correctly in every different type of situation. And once you think correctly, so that should affect the many areas that you be, in other words, override the emotion. But the areas where it doesn't override the emotion, those areas, then those powerful emotions, then you have to deal with the emotion itself. In the Parshas Emor, that's Vayikra Perichav Gimel, That's Leviticus 23, verse 2 and 3. So 2 said, talks about, it's an introduction, and it says that they're going to talk about the holidays, and you should call it holy. Then there's the break, and they stop talking about the holidays, and for one verse, they speak about the Sabbath. Okay, they jump in and throw in the Sabbath, which is not a holiday. Okay, so Rashi asks, what is the relationship between Shabbos and the holidays? Why are they close by? Why are they in close proximity? Like, in fact, it breaks up the subject. First, says we're going to talk about the holidays. Okay, and then it starts talking about the Sabbath for one verse. And then it comes back to the holidays. It says it's to teach you that anybody that violates the holidays, we attach to him as if he violated the Sabbaths. And all that fulfill the holidays, they keep the holidays, so then we place upon him as if, or we attach to him as if he fulfilled all the Sabbaths. Okay? So the question is, what is Rashi's answer? I mean, of course, I mean, God gave both laws, and why should they be different, and they should be equal, you see? That is the question. Well, what is Rashi's answer? Rashi doesn't really answer the question. Question is, that there is a difference here. So he says the difference is that if you keep the holidays, it's equal to keeping the Sabbath. Well, of course it's equal. Of course it's equal. They're both given by God.
However,
you have to know how the difference between the Sabbath and the holidays come about. Sabbath comes about every week. Friday counts 6 days, and that's the 7th day Sabbath. Now the courts, the Besdin, decides when we have a new month. Okay, the courts decide when there is a new month. Okay, hold on. Now Rosh Chodesh, or the new month. The way it comes about, you see, we have either 28 or 29 days every month. Okay? Now, the way we make a decision on the whether it's a 28-day month or a 29-day month, at the night of the 28th, two witnesses come to court, and they tell you how the moon looks. And the court questions the witnesses about how the moon, they have charts, and they question the witnesses, and then they decide if that night should be the new moon or the next night should be a new moon. Okay?
Why is it court?
Now, the thing is, since we're dealing with human beings, so there could be mistakes. The witnesses could have described it. They weren't clear. I mean, they just... Or the court, I mean, there's all human beings, there's a lot of human error. Now, all our holidays are based on the month. In other words, when the holidays come out the following month is based on when the courts decide when the new month has come about. Okay? So, therefore, if the courts made a mistake, and they made one day, whichever it is, whether the 28th day, the 29th day is the new month, or the 30th day is the new month, whichever one they say. So it could come out that you have a holiday not really on the designated day. You see? In other words, on Shabbos, there can't be any mistake. Because Shabbos, every 6 days, and then it's the 7th day. That's it. That's not in our hands. But however, the holidays is in human hands because they decide when Rosh Chodesh or the new month is going to be. You see? And if they make a mistake, so we're not keeping the holiday. Right?
Rabbi?
The thing is, just clarification. In other words, insofar as halacha is concerned, it is correct. But insofar as reality is concerned, it's the wrong day. In other words, it really is the wrong day. That should not be the holiday. We made a mistake because of witnesses or whatever. For whatever reason, they made a mistake. You see? So therefore, reality, we're not keeping the holiday on the correct day. Okay?
No, wait, no.
Okay, so the answer is like this. In other words, the God has many systems, and we accept that God maintains all systems. Okay? That God maintains all these systems except one. And that is the system of justice. God gave us the system of justice on Mount Sinai, but then he gave it over to the human being to run with all the weaknesses of the human being. You see? We are responsible for running the system. We have to take responsibility for running the system, and it must be run according to the system, even with all human weaknesses. You see, with all human weaknesses, we must obey the sages, and that is the system which we must keep. In other words, like this, there is really no difference between Shabbos and Yontif. Shabbos, you can count 7 days, and you know that's in the hands of God. I mean, it's very easy to keep Sabbath. But the Yontif, since the new month is dependent on our sages, so the thing is therefore it might not come out the same day. It might not come out the correct day. So therefore, what God is saying here, according to Rashi, that despite the fact that there are human weaknesses and human mistakes, you are obligated to listen to these sages because that is the law which God set down and that God wants you to keep with all its mistakes, so that you should keep it, and that is equal to the Sabbath, which is not dependent on a human being. I'm sorry, the question is, what does this have to do with justice? I say the Torah system, okay? That God wants us to maintain the Torah system, okay? Instead of using the word justice, say that God wants us to keep the Torah system. And that is what Rashi is saying. Rashi is saying is that whether it, we know directly from God there could be no change, there's still and we know it from God, there is no difference that way, or if they make a mistake on the holidays, what the holiday is. That's 100% we have to keep the holiday, and that is equal to keeping the Sabbath. Even if we keep the wrong day, that's equal to keeping the Sabbath. We find in the throughout Talmud that there's many different arguments, and we make decisions on these arguments, and it could be we're making decisions different than the way Moshe gave it on Mount Sinai. If Moshe came down today and says, we are not keeping the laws the way he gave it on Mount Sinai, we would not be allowed to listen to Moshe. We'd have to listen to the people that make decisions in law today, because that is God's will, that the system should be maintained by people and not by prophets. A prophet came down and says you should change the law, you burn him at the stake. I mean, he's a false prophet. No prophet could change the laws. There are particular cases, but that's within the system where they're allowed to. There are certain areas where a prophet is allowed to, but it's within the system, and you have to know the system, when yes, when not. What I'm trying to give with these examples, again, is that you see that God gave over the system of Torah to Israel, you see, and to the Sanhedrin, the courts of Israel, and they make decisions what the law is, and even if it's not exactly what was said on Mount Sinai, and even if they make mistakes, we're obligated to obey them because that is God's will. All right, I would like to discuss the conscience, okay? The conscience, the purpose of the conscience is to stop the desire of the animalistic part of the human, okay? And when it does it, it makes you deny the desire, you blanks out the desire of the unconscious. In other words, it stops you from looking at yourself and to see these desires. In other words, let's say you have a desire to murder somebody and you don't want to see it. So you blank out that thing and that becomes part of the unconscious. You never see it. Okay? That is the way the conscience stops you from even viewing the desires of the animalistic part of you. Okay? Both the conscience and the animalistic part are both part of your unconscious. In other words, you're not aware of it because you refuse to look at that part of the mind, refuse to look at your desires because of the conscience. Okay? In other words, if you have a desire as a child to kill or to do other things, whatever you, right, violence or whatever it is, so the thing is that the conscience comes in and turns your mind away from it and you stop viewing it. Okay? In the real world, there are three things that we have. Like, for instance, I do something that's philosophically wrong. I know it's the wrong thing to do, so I feel ashamed. Feel ashamed that you're not up to reality. In other words, there's a certain level of a human being where he relates to reality and he feels he's not living up to reality, so he feels ashamed. But however, let's say, for instance, you violate law, like, for instance, you punch somebody in the nose, so then you're guilty of a crime. You're guilty of a crime, and because of that, you deserve punishment. Okay? And there's another thing called fear, realistic fear, that people have. Somebody takes a knife on you, you're afraid. You understand? So there's a realistic fear of something out of your control that can harm you or do harm to you, so therefore you have fear. An example of shame is, let's say, for instance, when the Twin Towers happened, or there's a war, and the stock market goes in such a direction that's very good for me, and I make a lot of money, and I feel good about it, which means I feel better about making money than people dying, which is against my philosophy of life. My emotions is not aligned with that philosophy. So therefore, I feel shame. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not guilty of any crime. I'm not afraid of anything. But I feel shame because I recognize that I don't have the correct view of life. In other words, when that catastrophe happens and I make the money, you see, now I didn't do anything wrong. But at that moment when I hear about it, what is my emotional reaction? That will show how real my philosophy is. In other words, if my, even though my philosophy might be that I really hold the value of life is more important than money, but at that moment, do I feel bad for the people that died, or do I feel good that I made the money? In other words, it's, you didn't do anything wrong, so it's a view of your soul. And therefore, if you think of the money prior to the people, and like there's even a good feeling about it, so then you feel shame, because your soul, your total being, the emotions within you are not in line with reality, so you feel shame. The question is that let's say, for instance, I feel good about the money and simultaneously I feel bad about the people. I don't think that's possible. I don't think it's possible that simultaneously there is something which has to come first. You see? In other words, what happens is if your emotions are in line with reality, you'll immediately think of the people that died. If your emotions are not in line with reality, what happens is, so you immediately feel good about the profits, but then the conscience comes in, and the conscience says, that's wrong, you're not living in line with reality. So therefore, you feel guilty about it. That is where your conscience is in line with reality. Let me clarify, it is not evil. In other words, what you feel is not evil, it just shows the nature of who you are. So if you feel good about making the money at somebody else's expense, you didn't do anything wrong. What happens is that you're, in other words, is that you're not satisfied. You feel ashamed because you notice that your emotions are not in line with your philosophical views or your sense of reality, what your reality should be. What your sense of reality should be is not there. So therefore, it could be you twisted around afterwards because of your conscience. The question is, what happens first? Okay? But one has to come before the other. Now, what happened was, in psychology, they took these three terms and applied it also to the conscience, that the tools of the conscience have fear, shame, and guilt. Okay? Now, but this doesn't work based on reality. It's based on the infantile mind. Your fear, shame, and guilt is based on the infantile mind, how it, and the way the parents trained the child, how it looks at life. Okay? Like, for instance, let's say, for instance, you're watching kids on a, young kids that put up a, have a play. And sometimes people in the audience feel embarrassed for them, right? Now, the question is, why should I feel embarrassed? It has nothing to do with me. I could recognize that they're doing something silly, something foolish, but why do I feel embarrassed? You see? The answer is that when that is happening, that there is awakened in my unconscious a desire. And the part that I refuse to look at is a desire which I'm not aware of. I don't know what the desire is. I'm unaware of it. But I have to have a desire for the shame to come through. Because the purpose of the shame is to stop the unconscious desire. Now, therefore, let's say, for instance, I would enjoy going... I would like to be the center of attraction, and I have a desire to be on stage. So therefore, that desire might, and the thing is that if I go up there, I have a feeling that I might do something stupid. So it's awakened the desire to do something stupid to attract attention. Like, let's say, for instance, a kid when he was young wanted a, their parents are having company, and they start acting up because they want to be the center of attraction. then the parent punishes them, and they feel ashamed of what they did. Now, so that when that desire is awakened to do something stupid, I'm not saying this is the only possibility. I'm saying this is a possibility, but there's a desire to stand up and do something stupid, so I have to stop it so the shame comes in immediately, which stops me. Okay? So therefore, shame is where I am not living up to the standard of what the way my parents raised me, and there's something I want, there's a desire to do my unconscious, so the shame comes in. That is where I'm not living up to the level of how I was raised to be. Okay, the next thing is, we also took the term guilt and applied it to the same thing, to the conscience. So therefore, there are some times where I do an act where I feel it's a terrible crime and I deserve a punishment. And sometimes, unconsciously, I cause myself harm as a result of this crime that I did. Okay? So therefore, guilt also is part of the conscience, but it works differently than shame, and that is, it makes me feel guilt that I've done a crime. That whatever I was reprimanded at as a child, I was somehow, to me it became a crime. In my infantile mind it became a crime, and I deserve punishment for that crime. You see? And therefore, certain people can actually punish themselves because in a situation where they feel that guilt and they deserve a punishment. Now we come to the last thing, fear. Fear is a threat from the outside. Now this works slightly different, and that is this. When the desire is awakened and I do not have shame or guilt, you see, and I become very frightened of this emotion. I'm afraid that the emotion will come out. So what the conscience does, it projects out onto others or to things that these people are going to hurt you. In other words, instead of me being the evil one, you see, I project that. That's how paranoia works. Paranoia works like that. Kids that are to change, because if we live in a society without any control, so then you can't keep you can't control yourself. Like, for instance, learning and keeping mitzvot takes a certain amount of control. But if I'm raised in a society without control, then the system will be lost. So therefore, what God did is He allowed or caused idolatry, but He allowed that idolatry should change from the animalistic part of the human to the conscience, so that when Klal Yisrael was in that type of atmosphere and raised in that atmosphere, so therefore at least they have control, as long as they don't go too far. With Torah, they would be able to pull out, with the ideas of Torah, they'd be able to pull out. But they're raised in that atmosphere, because the atmosphere that you're raised in has a big effect on you. And so therefore you see that God intervenes only insofar as protection of the as protection for the nation as a whole, to protect the nation, that the nation shouldn't disintegrate. Okay? We also have an obligation to imitate God. In other words, we can't imitate God like Him for miracles, but there's certain things we're supposed to do and try to carry out the will of God. Okay? Now, when we lost the second base of Hamikdash, there was a terrible fear that the system would be lost. And from proofs and investigation into the system, they found a license to write down the oral law, to write it down. And at that time, they were doing that again Now, sages were doing it to protect the system. So you see that God intervenes even now only in the system as a whole, that the system shouldn't disintegrate. And if anything goes wrong with the system, that's where God intervenes, to protect the system, either the physical system of Klal Yisrael or the spiritual system of our halachic and philosophical system. He protects that. Okay, now, some Rabbi Akiva was to follow the Torah. Our whole transmission from Mount Sinai was to follow with Rabbi Akiva. Now, there are certain defects. If I have these defects, it's going to affect the way I see ideas. And if it affects the way I see ideas, it's going to harm my students. It's going to harm our people when you give it over. Now, if this is the only source for the transmission from Mount Sinai, and the people that were transmitting it would have incorrect ideas, you see, then the whole transmission would come across incorrect, which is outside God's will. In other words, you would not see. In other words, God's will, like when sometimes we have a machlokas, a difference of opinion. Well, God says that's the part of the system, and he allows that even though we're not doing exactly what God said on Mount Sinai. But certain things corrupt and remove the whole value and benefit of the system. God recognized that these 24,000 students, if they were they passed on the transmission, the Masorah. In other words, the person that lives correctly, even though their emotions are not in line with it, that person is still doing the right thing. They're living the right life. They're still better off than the other people. But however, they can get their emotions in line with that reality. In other words, if we had to summarize laziness, laziness is a lack of the sense of reality. In other words, because their sense of they want results, but in their reality there is no means. They don't want the means. They refuse to accept the means. We want to know if acting flaky is laziness, okay? So we wanted to define the flaky. Flaky is where a person has, like let's say a person has a good mind. They project on others that they're naive and they don't know things and they don't understand things. They project out onto others a lower ability than they really have. That's what flaky is. Flaky is where you try to project an infantile or childish or non-responsible view of yourself than what you might really are. You might really be flaky, or it might be just a projection, you see? But many times it's just a certain act that you act that way for various reasons. I don't know the reasons, but whatever the reasons are, I mean, it might be because you want to excuse yourself for responsibility. You might... What was your reason? So that you protect yourself. You understand? You don't put anybody down, so people might accept you more. I mean, because you're lower than them. You understand? And you protect yourself from responsibility because nobody expects too much of you. So these are the different reasons that might be why a person might become flaky. But I think it's different than flaky is a different thing. Different than unless flaky is where I don't want responsibility and I'm refusing to take responsibility, then it would fit into laziness. But if it's the other reasons, then it's not necessarily laziness, and it would be a different emotion other than laziness. A flaky person is not always irresponsible. A flaky person is a person that projects.
sometimes he could be irresponsible, and sometimes he could be lazy, and that's why he's flaky. But many times flaky is a projection for some reason, some facade that they, for whatever psychological reason, they project something like an infantile type of action. So for some reason, that is what we call flaky. There's two types of flaky. One is put on and one is not put on. When a person acts flaky, it's like an infantile act. But sometimes it's put on, sometimes it's real. Hey, the question is that, let's say a person is lazy, or a person operates logically not lazy, but however mostly they are lazy, what can they do? What can the lazy person do to cure himself? And what can the person that is not lazy but emotionally is in conflict with it, what can they do to undo the conflict? Okay? The answer is I think it's a study of reality, of exactly what we've been doing, you know, during these discussions and different studies of how we define Musser. So,
the selfish fool who will totally destroy themselves. That's a large book, a large part of the book of Proverbs and Mishlei. Well, I had this discussion in another situation, and somebody says, why are you using the word selfish? Don't use the word selfish. Try to find other words, you see. I explained to him that in America, selfish seems to be a terrible connotation, but it's really the only word that can be used, okay? The thing is that you are selfish. See, the thing is like this. Let's say, for instance, like in America, they tell you that you should be nice to others. You're trained to be nice to others. Be nice. Now, that's only part of the conscience, you see. So, of course, you were trained to be nice, so you repress your desires, your hostility desires, your anger, aggressive desires. You hide that and act nice, okay? But since you're controlling your hostility and your anger, that must come out at a certain point. And niceness falls by the wayside. You see? It is really not going to last. That is the total fake out, because it's only the conscience that's doing it. And then the other part is going to come out. By what right do you have to insult me? I'm willing to be nice, but under certain conditions, I'm not going to be nice, you see? But if it's selfishness, if you're kind because you see that it's more beneficial for you, that will help you maintain it, that in those situations where it's better to control yourself, that you will. I'm not saying all situations it's good to control yourself. Sometimes you should have an outlet for anger. Or if you could find a different way. Sometimes, let's say, for instance, somebody insults you and you feel it would be a terrible catastrophe to answer back. Well, sometimes you could work out your anger. That's what Mishlei would advise, to work it out. But on the short run, you know, people exercise to get rid of the negative. Some people throw darts. They put pictures up there and throw darts. I don't know. Whatever it is, some people have a punching bag. But whatever it is, there are short run outlets that might be better But on the long run, it's better to find out why you're angry and how to deal with it and how to undo it. But however, the only term is selfish. This is the nature of the human being. And it's not a bad connotation. It's bad if you carry out your selfishness in a stupid way. That is bad. That's the fool that Proverbs talks about, you see. But however, the wise person will know how that he should have the least amount of pain and the best and the maximum of enjoyment, so that he'll work out these different emotions that take away from his enjoyments of life or cause him unhappiness. In other words, you got to be careful. Certain people draw the line between selfish or self-interest, or they draw the line between a small S or a big S. The question is how they define it. We're saying only one thing, that you must define it, the distinction, the differences between either you act wisely or you act foolishly. Now, it's for your self-interest or it's for your selfishness. I don't care what word you use. But if they do not make that distinction, then, I have to see what the distinction is and why they're making it. But however, our distinction is between foolishness and intelligence. The question is, what is the definition of wise and foolish, okay? The answer is, I think basically it's consequences, like we gave the example before. If you can have 3 hours of unhappiness, and you could avoid it by just controlling your, from answering back, in other words, so then you're avoiding a certain consequence. Now, if you have problems holding in your anger, so then you might want to work out your anger in a better way, instead of fighting with your spouse. You understand? So then, like I said, there's 2 steps. One is immediate. You might have to go jogging or walking or do something that'll make you forget it, or for a drive. Some people go out for a drive and they feel better. And there are other people, but the second stage, which is really the most important, is to try to deal with the anger itself so that it shouldn't bother you at all when you're put down, but look at it simply in a realistic manner and how to deal with the situation realistically. In other words, you have to evaluate the time that you would be unhappy if you answered and the time that would be more beneficial if you did not answer. Now, when you evaluate that should be an objective decision where you could prove it, and if you discuss it with others, you should be able to stand up and defend your position. So therefore, it should be an objective proof that the time that you're evaluating is, or whatever you're evaluating, that the consequence is not worth that action which you're going to carry out now, is simply not worth it. And so therefore, then you have to learn what to do with the emotion that is being controlled, because there is an emotion to carry it out. So then you have to learn how to deal with the emotion. So if you go to somebody else for advice, the advice, you should, it's not a matter of carrying out their advice, but other people should try to give you possibilities of how you should operate in this situation. Now, once they give you possibilities, then you have to think through these possibilities, and as you reject maybe your own possibility or their possibility, then you start making a more and more intelligent discussion. That's what you need somebody to talk it over with. Not to pat you on the back and say whatever you do is right, and not to tell you what to do, but that they should give you possibilities what you would not think of on your own. That's what you really need an advisor for.
Then you factor that in.
Okay, I'd like to discuss, there are 2 views of how God's hashgacha, personal relationship to Israel, works. One is that God relates to each and every individual every moment and every second of the day. And everything is a miracle. Even crossing the street is a miracle, according to them. There are others that hold no, that God relates to us, leaves the individuals to a large extent in the laws of nature. He's aware of every individual, and he can intervene if he wants to, but he usually intervenes through prayer or if you're on a certain level. Okay? So these are the 2 views of God's hashgacha, of his personal relationship to us. And for those that hold that God's personal relationship is a constant, and even crossing the street like as if there's no laws of nature, you see, so they live constantly under God's, according to them, they live constantly under God's hashkacha, and God is constantly intervening. What I'd like to do is ask a few questions against that view of life. If you pray, in other words, according to the second view, if you pray to God, that's one way that God can intervene in the laws of nature and might work out things for you.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
So we asked them the question, okay, if we asked them the question of why do they look both ways when they cross the street, they answer that they have to, that God wants them to live as if the laws of nature are really working. This is their, this is the way they answer. Their answer is as if the laws of nature do work, and God obligates us to look both ways, that we should live according to the laws of nature, even though really God is intervening, and it is God that will get us safely across the street, and not because we were careful in crossing. The first question is, so they, insofar as practicality is concerned, they have to make decisions like me. Right? Their life, practically, their life is no different than the way I would live, because I live as if the, that the laws of nature really do exist.
But if they really believe that...
Well, that is the first question. That they, in other words, practically the way they live their life, they must live it exactly the way I live my life. Second question is what you also mentioned, is that they can't trust their five senses, because they see somebody's killed by the truck, and they say, no, it's not the laws of nature that did it, but God made the truck hit him. You see, so they can't trust what their mind sees. In the law, in the, with, through their five senses. Okay? Now, the thing is that the truth is that, see, the difference between the way they do their act, in other words, they answer, it might be true that we have to live like you, but the way we, but in their minds, how we relate to it is different. How do they relate to it? They relate to it as a command of God, right? So it comes out, for me it's a practical thing that I have to look two ways. But for them it's a command of God, so they should keep it even stronger than me. Mm-hmm. Because they should, right? Because it's a command of God. Is that correct? The question is, why is it a command of God to them? Because the thing is that when they cross the street, the laws of nature are not working. But God wants them to live as if the laws of nature do work. So therefore, it's a command of God, right? Now, it's very interesting. It's very interesting that if you look at these people, they live correctly where it affects their five senses. But where it comes to the ideas of Mishlei, namely where you have to make a decision based on your ideas, based on consequences of in the future, that they don't live. You see? They don't... What? What? In other words, like, I mean, they would never analyze how, let's say, haughtiness would lead to destruction and the consequences. They won't, in other words, their moral system and ethical system is not based on consequences like Mishlei is. A different system, you see. But practically, since they must live a practical life, they should, by order of God, so they should really work out every detail of it. But I notice when I speak to these people that the truth is that they only keep it by their five senses, you see.
You mean a person?
I'm not saying he'd be haughty, but he would make decisions not based on consequences. And he would not work out, he would not hold that's an important thing. The important area is only that he's forced to live within the laws of nature as his five senses, I notice. But not where it comes to his mind in working things out. That I do notice. But what I notice from these people is that basically the idea of consequences is only in the five senses. They don't look at it as consequences, they look at it as that God says that I have to do it.
Okay.
In other words, from what I could see, they don't do our type of self-examination in the laws of nature. In other words, see where I made a mistake and why I made a mistake in my decisions. And how, you know what I mean? That they don't analyze that. Only everything is in the hands of God, and therefore you should only repent in so far as Allah is concerned and so far as God is concerned. But insofar as the laws of nature, there's not real study in it, you see. But if it's a command of God that you should live within the laws of nature, they should keep this part more than anybody. Now, the thing is that the reason, you see, I say that it's impossible. See, in other words, it's really impossible for them to study Mishlei. Why? Because really, the practical, they know that the practical is not real. They're caught in a conflict. Their five senses tell them it is real, and in their mind they say it's not real.
Okay.
What? In other words, like I said, they look both ways, but they really hold that they should be able to cross without looking and be protected by God.
Really?
Yeah, that's what they hold. They hold that the whole thing of crossing the street is a protection of God. That's what they hold, that God intervenes every single second in their life. Now, since they're distorting the whole reality, they're caught in a terrible conflict because they have to deny what their five senses tell them, you see? So therefore, but the conflict is only with their five senses where it's so obvious. But they're certainly not going to go and analyze the ideas that have to do with the reality, you know what I mean? And they're definitely not going to go that far. You see, psychologically, it's impossible because it'll only bring up more questions. It will show them that every aspect of life is guided by the laws of nature, and you must have to work out your plans based on the laws of nature. So therefore, they would not go that far.
So what do they do with
that? Let me get that on. Okay, I'd like to give a summary of one aspect of Ashrei. Ashrei deals to a large part with the animal kingdom, namely all the animals plus the humans. Okay? So the question is, how does God relate to the animal kingdom? So in Ashrei, chapter 145, Kuf Mem Hei, verse 8, that's Pasuk Ches, it says, Chanun v'rachum Hashem, God is gracious and merciful, Erech Apayim, takes him long to get angry, Ugadol Chosed, and great kindness. Okay? So the thing is that the Radak explains it. Chanun v'rachum, the first two, okay, the first two attributes of God, namely how he relates to us, not an attribute of God, it's how God relates to us, is gracious and merciful. Okay? Gracious, he says, this is for the whole animal kingdom, in the laws of nature. Namely, gracious is he satisfies every creature his needs. In other words, the monkey has to, you know, swing from a tree. He needs a tail, so God created a tail. He has to satisfy each individual according to their way they were created. He must satisfy their needs. Rachum means that he created every animal that they have predators. So as a species, they are protected. There's individuals that will be eaten by the predator, but however, the species as a whole will be protected, and this goes for the whole animal kingdom plus the human being. But that basically ends the knowledge that we need for the animal kingdom without the human. You see? In other words, to see clearly how each animal as a species is being satisfied, every physical need is being satisfied, and every instinct is being satisfied, and how they are protected from their predators, or maybe even from diseases by the making of their inner body, which protects them against diseases, but that would be protecting them. So those are the two qualities. Now the rest is basically the human being. Now, the human being, because he has something different than the animal, namely emotions, you see, so we have to take care of that. So one thing is, when he's born, his emotions make him see life incorrectly. So he'll definitely make mistakes, right? A child and teenagers must make mistakes. But they're given a certain amount of years before they'll get the consequences for that mistake. So therefore, God does not, in the laws of nature, most mistakes in the laws of nature, the consequences are not immediately. There are a few things that are immediately, you know, but most of them are not, and you have a chance to undo the problem. That's why he doesn't punish right away. Now, because he has emotions, he has the need to satisfy certain emotions. So therefore, gedol chosed, it means great kindness. What's the great? It's beyond the physical. The animal doesn't have emotions. All his instincts are guided for the survival of the species. So therefore, that's it. It's a practical thing. But a human being practically does not need a lazy boy to sit on. A comfortable couch is not necessary to have to live. You could live without it. Okay? God gives us the right to satisfy our emotional needs. We have the right to satisfy our emotional needs. But however, not to make mistakes that we should cause ourselves harm, there are two things. There's two pleasures that you should not partake of. One is if it's against halacha, right? Or two, if it will cause you harm, right? In other words, if you cross street blindfolded, that'd be stupid. So therefore you should not. In other words, otherwise you can't enjoy the emotional pleasures. God is not against that. That's gedol chosed. Okay. In other words, a person enjoys ice cream once a week, twice a week. It's not bad. Or sweets once or twice a week. But if more would be no good, or a diabetic it would be no good. You see? So therefore, where you can, you should. There's nothing wrong in enjoying these emotional things, even though physically you don't need it. Okay? Now, then it goes into detail about different aspects, and then Pasuk Yud Ches continues about God's relationship to the human based on Hashgacha Pratis, God's personal supervision. So he says in verse 18, he says, God is close to all that call him in truth. What does that mean? Anybody that prays to God, prayer works. But there is one condition. It has to be in truth. Truth means he has to know what the ideas of the prayer are, and that he has a conviction that prayers can work. You see? Then the prayer can work on any human being. Okay? Then God can intervene for that human being. It's not necessarily. There might be other factors why he won't. But it can work. That's where God can intervene for you, and he does. Prayer does work. Then Pasuk Yates, that's verse 19, he says, the will of those that fear him he does, and when they cry out he listens and helps them. Fear of God is where I do the correct actions because of consequences. In other words, I feel that if I violate the Torah, then God could punish Israel. Enough people violate the Torah, God could punish Israel. The consequences whatever I do wrong, there are consequences. So the person that relates to God through consequences, that's fear of God. So the thing is that God listens to him when he's in trouble. When he's in trouble, based on who he is. See, the first stage is that God says, prayer works. Whether you're on the level or not, prayer works. But there is a certain person that when he relates to God through fear, God listens to him when he calls out to him, you see, or prays to him, based on his nature, based on his relationship to God, you see. To him, you don't have to say, call out in truth, because he knows God and he knows how to do it correctly. The only thing is his motive is consequences, so therefore he relates to God. That is verse 19. Now, verse 20, it says, God protects all that love him. Person that loves God is a person that relates to God directly, and he does things not because of consequences, but because it's God's will. So it says God guards him, so the commentaries say that they don't allow bad things to happen to him. There are certain times when God does God will cause bad things to happen to him because he needs help in his development and God wants to help him develop. But otherwise, if there's something that has nothing to do with his development, God will protect that person even before he gets into trouble, protect him from getting into trouble itself. And then the wicked he destroys. The wicked are destroyed in one of two ways, either through the laws of nature, because they violate the laws of nature, and so therefore they bring their own consequences. Well, for some reason God can't intervene in certain situations, will intervene and destroy the wicked. Okay? So therefore this is, so in other words, what we have here is a picture of the whole animal kingdom, and since the human is part of it, we have to subdivide. So the animals and the human need in the laws of nature that God should give them their needs and protect them from harm. And then within the laws of nature, the human being, God does not punish right away. In other words, you don't get the consequences right away, so that you could work out your emotions and live a good and undo any consequences that could have come. That's also within the laws of nature, and you have the right to satisfy your emotional needs. That's all within the laws of nature. Then God's personal relationship to you, that's three steps. Either really you're not on the level for God to relate to you, but God said prayer works. So therefore, the prayer works, but you have to do it in truth. Okay, that means knowing what you say, understanding the idea of what how it works, prayer, and two, having a conviction that prayer does work. And then if you're on the level of fear, so then God listens to you when you're in trouble. If you love God, that's through knowledge of God's universe. Through the universe, you relate to God, not through consequences. So then you just want to do God's will. So then God protects you against certain consequences. And the evil person could sometimes die under the laws of nature because he did stupid things, or God can intervene and destroy him. That is God's relationship to the animal kingdom. Yeah. The question is how come bad things like for babies that didn't do anything wrong, how come the terrible things happen to them? Because they're under the laws of nature. Under the laws of nature, it can happen. Okay, not everybody's under God's hashgacha. Yeah. And I'm not saying that God doesn't relate personally to the individual like it seems to be, that between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, God relates to the individual at a higher level, and therefore prayers at that time are more important. But God is aware. You have to know that God is aware of who you are. That's for sure. Even though he might decide not to intervene. Whatever reason, decides not to intervene. But however, God is aware of every human being. Right. We'll clarify a little bit what we mean by fear and love. Well, let's put it this way, how you get fear and love, okay? Then that will make a clear understanding. If you study the Book of Mishlei says it will help you become a chacham and a tzaddik. Chacham is a person, we gave this already, but a chacham is a person that because of his, he has personal desires. But he realizes to get it would be doing it in an intelligent way would be better. That's a chacham. And a tzaddik relates to the system of justice. Okay? He recognizes that he is part and parcel of a system of justice, and therefore he relates to the system of justice. This book would teach you fear of God. In other words, once I see consequences, and I see consequences of doing evil and what could happen, let's say, for instance, I know that if Klal Yisrael is punished, I'm part of the nation of Israel, I could also be punished. You understand, if I'm part of a certain nation that God, or another nation God could punish, you know what I mean, where they're very evil, if you're part of that nation, then God could punish you. So therefore you might want to try and change the nation or get out. You say, a Jew can't get out, but the thing is that, so therefore he might want to do good so that he could benefit Klal Yisrael, and in that way he will be benefited. You say, that is fear of punishment and desire for reward. Okay? When you study the Psalms, and you study how in the Psalms, it teaches two subjects, namely how God relates to us, this Hashkafa Pratis, that it's based on good and evil, how we relate to the world and to God, and also talks about the sciences, like this very chapter that we just showed. It shows how God relates to the animal kingdom and the wisdom behind it. As you study these systems, through the wisdom of these systems that is mentioned in Psalms, and in other places also, so then you see God's wisdom, you're drawn to God via His wisdom. Once you're drawn to God via His wisdom, then there's a tremendous desire just to do God's will. It has nothing to do with reward or punishment. The person would not care. He just wants to be in line with reality. And since God is the source of all reality, he wants to be in line with that reality. You see? That is what we call love God. You see? When you reach that level that you're drawn to God via God's wisdom in the universe. So if a person has an incorrect view of God, I mean, that means he didn't study it this way. He didn't come to God in the correct manner. Let's say, for instance, a person is a religious person, has a religious emotion. Okay? Now, we know millions of people have religious emotions, and they have incorrect views of God, you see? Now, a person, in other words, we say that that's good to start out with a religious emotion, but then through the study of Torah, straighten out that idea so that it should be a correct idea of God. You see? So therefore, in other words, like this, let's say, what do you need to get a portion in the world to come? So there's a difference of opinion. There is Albo, who holds that all you need is a proof. You must know without a doubt that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, and you study the Torah. Whether you have right understanding of Torah, an incorrect understanding of Torah, you get a portion in the world to come. According to Maimonides, he holds that you must have that. You must know that God gave the Torah. But from the Torah, you must know the 13 basic principles that, and it's really 13 basic principles of knowledge of God that you must that you must have a conviction about to have a portion in the world to come. You see? So therefore, there are certain basics what you have. In other words, if you hold from Albo, then let's say somebody holds God as physical, but he accepts it because the way he read the Torah, it seems to be God as physical. Now, by the Torah, I mean the conviction that God gave the written law and the oral law. For those people that only hold the written law, that is not acceptance of Torah. You see, acceptance of Torah means the written law and the oral law. So it depends which one you hold, you know, is right. But in other words, your question is, do you have an incorrect view of God? Depends on Albo or Maimonides. According to Albo, if you have an incorrect view of God, as a result of studying Torah, not as a result of studying philosophy, but as a result of studying Torah, you have an incorrect view of God. So you say, look, this is the Torah told me. This is the way I understand it. Can't understand it better. According to the Rambam, no, you must have a correct conviction of God. So it depends who you hold by, which is right. I have to answer that question. Let those reasons have an idea of God, but it doesn't come from Torah. have an idea of God. It's a wrong idea of God. It doesn't come from Torah. Everybody holds, both Albo and the Rambam will hold, that you don't have a portion in the world to come. You must have, even according to Albo, there's a certain minimum which you need to get a portion in the world to come. That is a conviction that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, and by Torah I mean the written law and the oral law. And so therefore when I read through the written law and the oral law, I see different views and I understand it in a certain way. Now let's say I get an incorrect view of God, I could still have a portion in the world to come. But if I have my own view of God, which I did not get from Torah, but I have a view of God which is incorrect, then if even according to Abba, I would not have a portion in the world to come. In other words, the minimum to get you into Olam Haba, into the world to come, is either according to Albo, according to Maimonides. But however, when we're talking about the Psalms and studying the universe, you see, then that is a closer relation that's beyond the minimum, and it gets, of course, then you get a higher place in the world to come, and you are closer to God. You see, there's a development, there's the minimum which gets you into Olam Haba. Then there's the development of your personal development that could give you a higher place in the world to come and a better life in this world and a closer relationship to God in this world. The thing is the question is about motivation. Well, what motivates you to keep Torah? So the thing is that some people are motivated by Olam Haba, by the world to come. Okay? Now the question is, if Olam Haba is so important, the question is, how come it's not written in the Torah about that you get reward? It doesn't say any place about Olam Haba. It's only the oral law that talks about a certain amount. But if it's so important, it should be in the written law. There are people that answer is because if it was written in the written law, it becomes such a powerful motive, and especially if it's written openly, that people would become so fixated with that, they would not be able to see any other thing, the love of learning and the benefits in this world. But I think there's also another answer, and that is that I don't really believe that if you understood the true Olam Haba, that it could be a motivation for a human being to work. It is a benefit that you do get, that you can know, but as a motivation, I think it has to be this world. I think that's the greatest motivation, where you see the benefit that you have in this world, whether you're on the level of fear of God or the level of love of God. It's all in this world.